Beef rib roast using the app, $9.99 a pound. You save $4 a pound. Whole young chicken on the app is $1.99 a pound. A four-pack tray of corn on the app is $3.99. You save $2. Stew's low-salt gourmet cooked ham on the app is $8.99 a pound. That's service counter only. And their low-salt gourmet turkey breast on the app, also $8.99 a pound, and also a service counter only. And that's it for the items that were posted online at Stew's. And those prices are good through the 23rd of April. So I hope we helped with your shopping. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Chris Radio, Connecticut's talking newsstand. It's 9:30.
This is Cross Currents on Chris, featuring the opinion pages of today's newspapers. Stay with us to hear what the editors, columnists, and your neighbors have to say about the world, national, and local issues that are making headlines today.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. We'll turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Hartford Courant, the date April the 16th. The opinion, chronic absenteeism in Connecticut schools has lasting effects on children, by Jennifer Openshaw. Like states across the country, Connecticut received federal dollars, $1.7 billion of the $190 billion doled out, to help reverse learning loss stemming from COVID. Some 50 million K-12 students were shifted from the classroom to the homeroom, quite literally, using online learning. The result? Chronic absenteeism. In the Nutmeg State, chronic absenteeism in the 2021-2022 school year was 23.7%, or more than 115,000 students, more than double the 10% before the pandemic. This past school year wasn't much better, 20% chronic absenteeism. Chronic absenteeism will have lasting effects, from poor academic performance to lower graduation rates to reduced earnings potential to decreased workplace productivity. Despite this diminished participation and the lower levels of engagement, over 70% of lower income Gen Zers say that online learning is their preferred method of learning. Clearly, there is a disconnect between system-delivered online education and Gen Z student expectations. Our experience at Girls with Impact is very different. Not only did young women, 14 to 24 years of age, from underrepresented communities, continue to register for our online business and innovation training programs in increasing numbers during the pandemic, but they stuck with it, engaged, learned a lot, produced stellar results, and raved about their experience. Classes, tuition-free for most, were instructor-led and delivered live, online. Those instructors using Zoom and our proprietary curriculum guided students from ideation to discovery, to broad business learning, to product pitch. Despite limited prior experience to business learning, to the essentials of entrepreneurship, and to the foundational power skills that are critical to success, even those from underserved communities engage and strive. The key is to find a way to capture students' imagination at the outset of a course, help them build on their innate, underdeveloped capabilities, and give them an opportunity to find their passion within the context of the course itself. One student, Lucy Cassell, compared her experience with her school's online learning with that of Girls with Impact. In school, online learning was a terrible experience. I've never loved Zoom classes because I felt like my teachers didn't know me, and I couldn't get to know my classmates. What are the things we learned about effective online programming over the years? Give students a framework for ideation to spur innovation skills they didn't know they had. When asked about her enthusiasm to start GWI, Bridgeport student Maya Rose said, "Because this is my idea, not someone else's." Encourage and support their work with regular positive reinforcement to build confidence both during and after classes. Employ instructors that look like them and come from similar backgrounds, those with whom they can relate as role models for the future. The fact that my GWI instructor was Black was tremendously motivating, said Shean Erlington, 21, from Hartford. Provide robust opportunities for them to engage with each other in class and between classes. These best practices can be applied to online offerings from our K through 12 and post-secondary educational systems. Turning now, again, April 16, the editorial in the New Haven Register. Kudos to Hurley's Drive for a three-peat. Thumbs up to the University of Connecticut's men's basketball coach, Dan Hurley, telling the 60,000 fans gathered in Hartford last Saturday what they wanted to hear, that his plans are to try to win a third consecutive national championship next season. UConn's success under Hurley sparked rumors he could jump ship for the coaching gig in Kentucky, but he made it clear that he had no designs on coaching for any other college program. Thumbs down to the disconcerting range in the times of emergency department stays in Connecticut. According to federal data, median stays at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London are about 98 minutes, while Hartford Hospital's median is 288 minutes. Such comparisons aren't really fair, but serve as a reminder of the staffing challenges hospitals are facing across the country and of the breadth of health issues that have arisen in recent years. Thumbs down to the toothless penalty for two Bridgeport detectives who failed to notify families of the deaths of two women. As the attorney representing the families of Lauren Smith Fields and Brenda Rawls said, the penalty of two paid holidays is a mockery. As though it couldn't get worse, the Bridgeport Police Union is appealing the discipline. Such brazen attitudes only draw more attention to such problems. Thumbs up to gas prices in Connecticut remaining below the national average. They've risen mildly as spring warms up, but stabilizing below $3.50 a gallon is still far below 2022, when we closed in on $5 a gallon. We hold out hope that prices will someday return to less than $3 a gallon. But experts expect increases as more people travel in the weeks to come. And finally, thumbs up to state senators unanimously voting to support legislation that would ultimately result in a study documenting the effects of bullying and hate speech. These problems are being felt in every community and demand more attention from leaders throughout Connecticut. A true leader's legacy. The Republican American editorializes on April 18. Somewhere Ronald Reagan is smiling. Over the past weekend, he witnessed the vindication of his 1980s brainchild, the Strategic Defense Initiative, aka SDI, aka Star Wars, as leading Democrats derisively called the program. Mr. Reagan, as president from 1981 to 1991, was the leading advocate of the idea that intercontinental ballistic missiles could be shot out of the sky from the ground, the air, or even outer space before they could deliver their payloads of death and destruction. He even spoke, during the 1984 campaign, of handing over the technology to the Soviet Union to exemplify America's goodwill. Vindication came April 13, when Iran launched an estimated 300 drones and missiles against Israel and scored no hits. Diverse defensive systems combined with Iranian incompetence prevented what could have been a bloodbath. At my direction, to support the defense of Israel, the U.S. military moved aircraft and ballistic missile defense destroyers to the region over the course of the past week, President Biden said on April 13th. Thanks to these deployments and the extraordinary skill of our service members, we helped Israel take down nearly all of the incoming drones and missiles. He didn't add that the people who survived the Iranian salvo also should be thankful to the defense policy preferences of former Senators Biden and Christopher Dodd, a Democrat from Connecticut, didn't prevail. The Wall Street Journal exposed Mr. Biden's wrongheadedness in September 2008 when he was running for vice president. He was a fierce opponent of Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. Peter Wehner, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, wrote September 4th of that year, Mr. Biden voted against funding SDI, saying the president's continued adherence to SDI constitutes one of the most reckless and irresponsible acts in the history of modern statecraft. Mr. Biden has remained a consistent critic of missile defense. Mr. Wehner added, "There are few members of Congress whose record on national security matters can be judged with the benefit of hindsight to be as consistently bad as Joseph Biden's." He didn't name names, but Kendall Svengalis in a 2004 Republican American op-ed did. In the 1980s, John Kerry was probably the biggest opponent of Reagan's policies, both foreign and domestic, aided by Senators Edward Kennedy, Christopher Dodd, and other members of the liberal Democratic appeasement camp. In the free world, there's a newfound appreciation for Mr. Reagan and the program Democrats laughably and stupidly called Star Wars. As for Mr. Biden, it was his good fortune that the policies he and his Senate comrades opposed so vigorously in the 1980s were in his toolbox 4 decades later, thanks to Mr. Reagan and others who saw the reality of the world more clearly than he did. Yet that doesn't change the fact Mr. Biden does not, and never did, understand what it means to lead the United States. Donald Trump and American Justice, April 17th, in the New York Times by the editorial board. The former and possibly future president of the United States is now on trial in Lower Manhattan. The first criminal prosecution of an American elected to the nation's highest office. Donald Trump, who relentlessly undermined the justice system while in office and since, is enjoying the same protections and guarantees of fairness and due process before the law that he sought to deny to others during his term. A jury of Americans will ultimately decide Mr. Trump's legal fate. It may be only one of 4 criminal cases against the former president that comes to trial before the November election. Though the election interference charges are not the most serious of those he faces, the case will determine whether 12 of his fellow Americans find him guilty of a felony, a result that most voters say they would consider to be serious. In the first 2 days of this trial, Mr. Trump has offered a defense of himself to the public. in brief appearances between his courtroom table and the television cameras. He portrays himself as a victim of an unfair, politically motivated prosecution. That defense is built on lies. Mr. Trump is no victim. He is fortunate to live in a country where the rule of law guarantees a presumption of innocence and robust rights for defendants. A guiding principle of the American experiment is that the law applies to everyone equally. At the same time, prosecuting any current or former elected official requires vigilance against bias and awareness about how the case will be perceived by the public. For this reason, judges and prosecutors have an obligation to hew to stringent standards of fairness to reduce the risk that they appear to be interfering in electoral politics by using criminal cases to damage or favor one candidate over another. The former president refers to the four prosecutions he faces as witch hunts motivated by partisanship and part of a nefarious scheme to keep him from returning to the White House. He has repeated this narrative even though the prosecutions have been brought by different prosecutors around the country, and even though different grand juries, each composed of a random selection of regular citizens in different states, handed up indictments that now total 88 felony charges against him. In the weeks leading up to the start of this trial, Mr. Trump has argued dishonestly that the judge and the prosecutor have treated him unfairly and that it will be impossible for him to get a fair trial in Manhattan because New Yorkers are biased against him. But the opening days of the trial, devoted to jury selection, have already demonstrated the great care and respect with which everyone involved in the trial, except for Mr. Trump, has treated the process. Joshua Steinglass, a member of the office of the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, told potential jurors on Tuesday that the case has nothing to do with personal politics. "We don't suggest you need to have been living under a rock for the last 8 years or the last 30 years," he said. "We don't expect you not to have heard about this or not to have discussed this case with friends. What we do need is for you to keep an open mind." Dozens of potential jurors took those instructions seriously and admitted they could not be impartial. One man was excused from service after telling the judge that it was going to be hard for me to be impartial since many of his family members and friends were Republicans. Justice Juan Merchan, the judge overseeing the trial, excused him as other potential jurors stepped up. So far, seven jurors have been seated. At least two potential jurors were dismissed by the judge because of social media posts. If anything, Justice Merchan has exhibited an extra degree of tolerance for Mr. Trump's strategy of systematically attacking the legitimacy of the courts and the court officials through repeated verbal outbursts and countless legal motions and other attempts to delay his trials. In the New York case, Mr. Trump received a short extension last month when federal prosecutors found a tranche of documents that had not been turned over to the defense team. In the week before the start of the trial, he filed three emergency appeals in 3 days, as the Times reported, including a civil action against the judge, which were quickly rejected by an appeals court. The fact that he was able to have each of these motions fully considered is evidence of the justice system operating as it should, with deliberation and due process. Especially in criminal prosecutions, courts take the legal rights of litigants very seriously to ensure that defendants receive fair trials. An appeals court is still considering Mr. Trump's request to throw out a gag order that prevents him from verbally attacking witnesses, prosecutors, or the judge's family, but it will not delay the trial before the ruling. Mr. Trump is not prevented from publicly criticizing the judge. In the other criminal cases against him, Mr. Trump has also been able to take full advantage of every legal protection available to him as a defendant. He appealed his federal prosecution related to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol on the grounds that he enjoys absolute immunity for actions he took as president. This argument has been rejected by every judge to consider it. Still, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the appeal later this month, delaying the start of his trial in that case indefinitely, and possibly until after the election. While the Supreme Court weighs his immunity claim, the trial judge in the federal January 6th case, Tanya Chutkan, put the proceedings on hold. In the other federal prosecution, on charges of illegally withholding highly classified national security documents, Mr. Trump has had numerous favorable rulings from the judge handling that case. The election interference case out of Georgia was delayed by an extensive hearing on a possible conflict of interest for the lead prosecutor, Fani Willis, who has been in a romantic relationship with Nathan Wade, an outside prosecutor she hired to lead the case. After taking testimony from a series of witnesses, the judge decided that Miss Willis could remain on the case, but not with Mr. Wade. Mr. Wade ultimately withdrew. Mr. Trump appealed that decision, which the Georgia Court of Appeals is now considering. The ability to file such appeals, successful or not, is essential to how the law functions in the United States. Despite having benefited from its protections to Mr. Trump, the rule of law is nothing more than an obstacle to be overcome, an instrument of power to use at will. Mr. Trump's vision of an American legal system that protects his interests goes beyond his trial, of course, and extends in particular to the Justice Department. He has been explicit about his desire, if elected in November, to bring the Justice Department more fully under his control, to use it to protect his friends, and more importantly, punish his enemies. Pals who let lunatic protesters tie up the nation's traffic are as bad as them. By the New York Post editorial board, published on April 16th. America is plagued with some truly disturbed people who think they have the right to screw fellow citizens by tying up the nation's traffic, and even more inexcusably, to defend Middle Eastern butchers and lob anti-Semitic smears against Israel. Worse, the political leaders who let them get away with it. On Monday, barely a day after the terrorist state of Iran launched a dangerously escalatory attack on the Jewish state, anti-Israel goons wreaked havoc at the Brooklyn Bridge in Lower Manhattan, California's Golden Gate Bridge, Chicago's O'Hare Airport, as well as Seattle, Philadelphia, and elsewhere. How many people missed a flight, couldn't get to a doctor's appointment, or were delayed to some other critical event because of their selfishness? Their supposed goal, besides making themselves feel virtuous, to pressure Team Biden to end support for Israel. The idea, of course, that imposing misery on fellow Americans can accomplish that is as bat crazy as their support for the terrorists. Make no mistake. Many of these rabble-rousers were openly backing Iran and its terrorist pawns, Hezbollah and Hamas. They shouted, "We love Hezbollah," and waved the group's banner, the same Hezbollah that launches rockets into civilian neighborhoods in northern Israel. They wore bandanas supporting Hamas, the same savages who raped, butchered and kidnapped innocent civilians in Israel and who promote the deaths of fellow Palestinians and then blame the Jewish state for it. Hands off Iran, protesters reportedly warn, the same Iran that murders women for wearing hijabs incorrectly, represses dissent, and promotes war throughout the Middle East. The biggest head-scratcher, supposedly, anti-war protesters who praised Iran's attack on Israel, even though it could trigger a massive region-wide war. They burned the American flag, a right granted to them by the very country they despise besides Israel. Try burning Iran's flag in Iran. Sure, every country has its sickos, yet America's leaders simply tolerate the enormous pain these lunatics inflict on others with their antics. Recall, they've been pulling stunts like this ever since October 7th. And no, this blocking roadways is not permissible free speech. True, some do get arrested, but many are instantly released and suffer virtually no consequences. The slaps on the wrist ensure more intense pain down the road, until America's leaders crack down for real once and for all, imposing hefty fines and prison sentences. Sane Americans will continue to suffer. Dan Haar, scaled down Connecticut housing ideas face a tough slog as the 2024 deadline nears. Here's why. April 18. In the New Haven Register. There are two ways to look at the half a dozen or so significant housing bills hanging in the balance as the state legislature enters its final three-week sprint, when most ideas die and few make it to the governor's desk. These housing ideas include tenant protections, one that's highly controversial, new programs for towns to extend sewer lines and reward affordable housing development, more money to reduce the number of people experiencing homelessness, new powers for housing authorities to develop projects outside the borders of their cities and towns, and a plan to rebalance the value of state and federal housing vouchers for low-income families so that the vouchers can pay for apartments in the suburbs. No single bill would change the game and turn around Connecticut's shortage of housing, or its famously segregated housing among towns, economically and racially too. Everyone agreed long ago that a short three-month session in an election year is not the time for advocates to push for the sorts of true, deep reforms that would force rich towns to allow more than just a token amount of affordable housing. Still taken as a whole, this year's list that could spark progress in what everyone agrees is a serious need in Connecticut for more housing, especially for more places to live for people who don't have a lot of money. The shortage hinders economic growth, at least for now, while jobs are going unfilled. In yet another illustration of the need, my colleague Alex Sewell reported Wednesday that house sales fell to an anemic low in the first 3 months of 2024 as prices break or approach records across the state. The short answer is no one knows. Amid the frantic horse trading and debates at the Capitol, mostly behind closed doors, now that the public hearing season is over. One view is that advocates for new state laws and programs in all sorts of areas, the environment, labor, economic development, public health, all feel slighted, forgotten, overlooked, and neglected. Not only is the whole General Assembly session only 3 months long, but there is little or no new money to go around because of state spending limits known as the guardrails, so no one feels much love. Another view, housing bills are especially left out of the cold because that view that they are evidenced by the fact they're not generating much buzz in comparison to how important housing is for the whole state. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the editorial and the opinion pages of the New York Times, the New York Post, the Hartford Courant, the Republican American of Waterbury, and the New Haven Register. I'm Larry Rifkin. So long. Until next time.
Serving Connecticut from studios in Danbury, Trumbull, Norwich, and West Haven, and our broadcast center in Windsor, we are KRIS, the Connecticut Radio Information System.